This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Anatomy of a Miracle, the true story of a paralyzed veteran, a Mississippi convenience store, a Vatican investigation, and the spectacular perils of grace. A novel by Jonathan Miles. Read for you by Eduardo Ballerini. A note on methodology. All the scenes and dialogue contained herein were reconstructed from the recollections of participants and observers and further supported, whenever possible, by audio recordings, video footage, diaries, notes, court transcripts, and other corroborating materials. In scattered instances where there remains a dispute in recollection, this discrepancy is parenthetically noted. 1 who believes all these tales is a fool. But one who denies them is a heretic. Hasidic saying, credited to Rav Shlomo of Radomsk. What happened? And his flesh came again, like unto the flesh of a child, and he was clean. Chapter 1. On the afternoon of August 23, 2014, Tanya Harris wheeled her younger brother Cameron to the Busy Bee store on the corner of Reconfort Avenue and Division Street in Biloxi, Mississippi. Nothing about the afternoon, or about Cameron, or about Tanya herself, suggested this would be her final time doing so. She was merely out of cigarettes, and her brother, slack-faced and sulky on a day that felt lethally humid, short on beer. Tanya Harris is a squat, wide-hipped woman of 29. Whose gently popped eyes lend her face an expression of perpetual surprise or amazement, and whose flat-footed manner of walking appears consciously orchestrated, as though she's never outgrown the fear of stepping on a crack, thereby breaking her mother's back. She'd recently dip-dyed one side of her hair, which is naturally a dingy shade of blonde faintly slashed with premature gray, and on this afternoon, streaks of a vividly chemical pink spilled down one side of a white T-shirt on which was printed, "Happy, happy, happy." Some of her many tattoos were already ridging from the heat, their edges swelling as though the ink was approaching a simmer. Pushing her brother's wheelchair down the center of Reconfort Avenue to avoid the uneven jags of the sidewalk and the many dunes of sand swept there, she maintained the freewheeling stream of humming, commentary, rhetorical questioning, and singing that is her hallmark to family and friends. "She does not shut up," grumbles her brother, with acerbic affection. "Not ever." The chorus to Jay-Z's song 99 Problems came flitting between observations about the swampy-ass August heat and her sharp denunciation of a neighbor whose neglected laundry, drooping on a mildewed clothesline, had already weathered, by Tanya's reckoning, its third rainstorm. "Gonna need to rewash every one of those shirts," she muttered, over the flap, flap, flap of her flip-flop spanking the asphalt. The sight of a chow mix chained to a ginkgo tree in another neighbor's front yard elicited the same cluck of pity it had been eliciting from her for almost a decade. Her brother Cameron wasn't listening, or if he was, he doesn't remember it. As he explains, "She repeats things 2 or 3 times if you're supposed to answer." McCameron was also, by his own admission, a little out of it. He'd popped his first can of Bud Light at noon to wash down the Klonopin and Concerta he was taking for anxiety and memory loss, and he'd followed that beer with 3, maybe 5 more. "Thermal angel blood," he calls it, a reference to a blood and intravenous fluid warmer he'd seen medics use during his combat tour in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was the last place Cameron ever walked. More precisely, on a ridge outside the mountain village of Sardasair in the Darakuj district of Zabul province, where in the early hours of March 22, 2010, Private First Class Harris and a fellow soldier wandered off course during a foot patrol. Cameron was roughly 12 yards away when the soldier, a staff sergeant, stepped on a PMN-2 landmine, a buried remnant from the former Soviet occupation. The explosion sheared off the staff sergeant's legs, genitals, and right forearm, and blasted 79 pieces of shrapnel along with bone shards from the sergeant's legs, into Cameron's body. One or more of those fragments severed the nerves of his lower vertebrae, instantly paralyzing him below the waist. Two doctors at the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany divulged the permanence of his condition to him on the evening of his 22nd birthday, bookending the news with brief and awkward apologies for the poor timing. Cameron's most prominent physical feature, paralysis aside, might be the long alabaster scar that runs down the side of his face, from just below his left temple, almost to his jawline. It's a squiggly, sinuous scar, evoking a river's course on a map, but it's not, as one might reasonably presume, collateral residuum from Afghanistan. The scar dates to his early childhood, when he slipped while running on a slick fishing pier and snagged his face on a nail. The scar only adds to the rugged, almost harsh cast of his face, which is further amplified by his high cliffside cheekbones, sharp-cornered jaw, the military specs trim of his blonde hair, and an angry vein in his neck that pulses and squirms from even the mildest aggravation. His eyes, however, cast a different spell. They're wide and large like his sister's, with a peculiar boyishness to them, as though his eyes retired their development at puberty while the rest of his features forged ahead. They impart a dissonance to his expressions that can sometimes be jarring. His temper, when it flares, can seem both fearsome and puerile. Most of all, however, those eyes highlight the gross tragedy of what happened to him in Afghanistan, that he had yet to fully graduate from boyhood when he was struck down in the Darakush. On this particular August afternoon, Cameron was dressed in his usual way, a T-shirt, this one advertising the Mississippi Deep Sea Fishing Rodeo, atop a pair of baggy black knee-length nylon shorts, and on his sockless feet, a pair of red Nike tennis shoes that he sometimes called his front bumpers. The home that he and Tanya share is a narrow, half-century-old shotgun-style house that wasn't designed with a wheelchair in mind. And without shoes, his insensate feet often bore bruises from colliding with sheetrock and doorframes. Their hometown of Biloxi occupies a skinny 6-mile-long peninsula that juts eastward into the Gulf. For most of its history, Biloxi was a fishing village, with canneries lining the water and shrimp boats and oyster luggers docked in its harbor. Immigrants drawn by jobs in the seafood industry, Slavs and Italians especially, lent the city an idiosyncratic seasoning, tilting its spirit more toward South Louisiana than to the rest of Mississippi lying north of the Salt Line. Most were Catholic, as the former Biloxian Jack Nelson explained in Scoop, The Evolution of a Southern Reporter, and they brought with them a more relaxed attitude toward drinking, sex, gambling, and other human frailties. In the 1950s, when the state dumped leftover dredging sand on the coastline to create an artificial beach, Biloxi began advertising itself as the Poor Man's Riviera, a deep south analog to Coney Island. Elvis Presley vacationed here. Jane Mansfield had just left a Biloxi supper club in 1967 when she died in a car wreck on US 90. Casinos arrived in the 1990s, adding another layer of sheen. And yet, for all its synthetic tropical print ease and its tolerance for frailties, Biloxi has never comported itself like a resort town. It bears no illusions of itself as a paradise. It doesn't mind the smell of fish guts. Its hands are cracked and calloused, and it sweats a lot. The Harris House, near the end of Reconfort Avenue, where the street dead ends at the CSX railroad tracks, is the only house Cameron and his sister have ever known. Their parents bought it in 1985, just after Tanya was born. After their father left for an oil field job in Texas when Cameron was 3 and failed to return, the children remained in the house with their mother. They remained in it, too, after their mother was killed in a car accident on I-10 when Cameron was 16. And they remained in it as well, if more accurately beside it, for a time, during the year they spent living in a FEMA trailer, after the storm surge from Hurricane Katrina devastated their East Biloxi neighborhood, their house included, just 14 months after their mother's death. The back bay kind of swallowed up the whole street, and flooded us up to the ceiling pretty much, Tanya explains, with a detachment that seems oddly clinical until you consider that Katrina, following so closely their mother's death, was for them less disaster than aftershock, loss tailing loss. The hurricane also explains why the house, which a group of volunteers from an Indiana church, with Cameron's help, put back together, is so starkly devoid of family history. The living room, once a shrine to their mother's porcelain collectibles, contained on this day a black vinyl couch purchased at a rent-a-center closeout, a television propped on cinder blocks, a blue plastic coffee table, upon which an Xbox video game console sat nestled amid its black burrow of cords, and nothing else. The walls, like those of every other room in the house, were unadorned and painted the blunt white shade of mold-resistant primer. The only photographs of Cameron and Tanya on display were the sole images, predating Katrina, that they know to exist. A half dozen snapshots, taped to the refrigerator door, that came in the mail from an aunt in Alabama whom the Harrises visited twice as children. Every one of them is a group shot, with Cameron and Tanya posed beside cousins whose names they don't remember. "That's all we got," Tanya says, pressing a fingertip to one of the photos, the only image of their mother they possess, as if to sponge a nano-droplet more memory from it. She hums, grunts, smiles. "Poor Cameron's got to take my word for it that he was such an ugly little kid." The outside shows minor neglect, curls of peeling paint, a cracked window pane, knee-high weeds poking through the concrete, but no more than some of the other surviving houses on the street. At least half didn't survive the storm surge. 9 years later, Reconford Avenue remains pocked with empty lots. Forgotten-looking for-sale signs stand wiltingly in a few of these sand-and-scrub parcels, occasionally joined by newer-looking signs advertising, in English and Vietnamese, legal counsel for oil spill claims resulting from the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the spring of 2010. The effects of that spill greeted Cameron's return home from Brooke Army Medical Center in Texas, adding insult to very literal injury, or loss tailing loss tailing loss tailing loss, an interminable freight train of misfortune. I remember Tanya bringing home a sack of oysters for this welcome home deal she did for me, and saying, "But Tippo says these might be the last Gulf oysters we eat in our lifetimes," Cameron recalls. And I'm thinking, well, shit, a lot of fucked up shit's happened to me, right? I mean, I could go down the list, you know, but no more oysters? Goddamn, man. I was just like, maybe life's really over now. It's unclear how earnest he is when he credits the oysters' comeback for his endurance of a 6-month murk of depression, though oysters, invariably cornmealed, fried, and slathered with ketchup, do comprise a notable share of his diet. Of the street's pre-Katrina residents, only two other households remain. One is a large Vietnamese fishing family known to Cameron and Tanya as the Ducks, a mangling of their surname, who keep sharply to themselves. The other is Mrs. Dooley. Eulalie Dooley is a 91-year-old African-American woman who's lived on the corner of Reconfort and Division, directly across from the Busy Bee, since 1965, when her late husband Bobby took a job with a local seafood processor. While working as a housekeeper, and later as a home health aide, she raised 4 children in that house, and later 3 grandchildren as well. She was the only resident of Reconfort Avenue who refused to evacuate for Katrina, which she survived, just barely, and when one considers her age and frailty, rather magnificently, by climbing into a floating refrigerator. As the water rose, she punched out ceiling tiles using the sponge mop with which she'd armed herself for the storm. The only chore Hurricane Camille had required of her in 1969 was swabbing the floors. She'd expected similarly light duty for Katrina. That feat of survival, reported on CNN, drew the Indiana church group to her home. A surplus of its volunteers moved down the block until they found the Harris House, teeter-tottering amid a sun-baked slosh of debris and yellowy mud, which they set upon with reciprocating saws and hammers and Midwestern Methodist cheer. To longtime residents of Reconford Avenue, Mrs. Dooley has always been known, fondly, as Neighborhood Watch. This is owing to her omnipresent vigils on her compact front porch, which by her request was the first thing the church volunteers rebuilt on her house. It's not uncommon to see Mrs. Dooley on her porch at sunrise, quilting or crocheting, while rocking in a chair that a charitable CNN viewer shipped to her all the way from Florida. Nor is it unusual to see her there after dark, beneath the bluesy glow of a bug zapper, needles still flashing in her ever-kinetic hands. Despite the intricate demands of her stitchwork, every passing car, whether familiar or not, is accorded a generous salute, her left arm fully raised, her arthritic wrist avidly swishing. As Cameron says, "It's like our street's got its own Walmart greeter." To him and Tanya, making their daily and sometimes twice or thrice daily walks to the busy bee, Mrs. Dooley tended to offer more than a wave. "How y'all babies doing?" she'd call out, leaning forward in her chair, or, "What you babies out shopping for today?" From Cameron in his wheelchair, she'd usually get a wan thumbs up or a meek and uncomfortable-looking shrug. He's never quite outgrown his fear of Mrs. Dooley, dating back to when she caught him, at the age of 10, setting off fireworks beneath cars, after which she ordered him onto her porch and slapped him 3 times hard on his backside, then told him to head straight home and have his mama slap him there another 3 times. For years thereafter, up until Cameron's mother died, instead of waving, Mrs. Dooley would point a stern and crooked finger at Cameron as he'd passed by on foot or on his bicycle, denoting her surveillance. "That boy was never really trouble," she says of the young Cameron. "More like he was always almost trouble." From Tanya, on the other hand, Mrs. Dooley's greetings yielded reams of small talk, the kind of blithe sentiments you holler across a front yard, and oftentimes requests for Mrs. Dooley to hold up her latest stitching project for Tanya to see. On the afternoon of August 23rd, Mrs. Dooley was halfway through a lighthouse-themed quilt, which she was proud to exhibit. Tanya, whose mother collected porcelain lighthouses, pretty much porcelain everythings, told her it was looking beautiful. As artists are prone to do, Mrs. Dooley challenged the compliment by inventorying all the mistakes she'd made, forcing Tanya to pause the wheelchair in the street in order to acknowledge them all and politely object to some. Cameron, Mrs. Dooley recalls, never glanced up. His expression looked dazed and bleary to her, but she didn't think much of it. She knew he took painkillers and chalked his torpor up to their effects. She didn't know, or didn't remember knowing, exactly what had happened to Cameron, or where it had happened, just that he'd walked off to war, the same way her husband had back in 1942, but unlike Bobby, Cameron hadn't come walking back. He'd come rolling. Roughly 20 years before that, she'd watched Cameron totter around the Harris's front yard in his diapers, his little pale legs fat like stacks of donuts, Tanya always shuffling alongside him with her arms splayed wide like a basketballer guarding against the fast break, Cameron's high-pitched giggles audible even from the corner. Mrs. Dooley preferred, however, not to think about that hard trajectory, the jinxed there to here. The world, like her quilts, was riddled with imperfections, but the reasons for these were known only to its creator. You just had to trust that the intentions were good. She sank back into a rocker and watched Tanya push Cameron's wheelchair into the parking lot of the Busy Bee. His elbows darted out momentarily as Tanya jostled the chair over a crumbled curb, reminding Mrs. Dooley of someone startled from a particularly vivid dream. Smokes, beer, Cap'n Crunch, a half-gallon jug of milk. This was Tanya's shopping list that afternoon. For other staples, she sometimes drove a red Kia to the Winn-Dixie on Pass Road or to the Walmart Supercenter down by the beach, but because she was 10 months into a 1-year driver's license suspension owing to a DUI conviction, driving anywhere was a sizable risk. She tried to limit herself to shuttling Cameron back and forth to the VA Medical Center in Biloxi, which was not only necessary, but seemed less likely to result in her arrest, or at least in her conviction. For day-to-day shopping, however, it was safer to load up at the Busy Bee, which stocks most of what you want if you don't want much. Moreover, she figured the sunlight and salt air were good for her brother, whose moods tended to blacken in the late afternoon before the beer and the pills got to fermenting in his bloodstream. Sometimes during those hours, when he'd be playing the video game Halo, she'd notice that neck vein of his seething, and a violent froth of drool bubbling at the corner of his mouth, and think, time to make some groceries. Today, however, wasn't one of those days. Today wasn't about distraction therapy, the clinical term that she'd later hear applied to her busy bee excursions. Today was listless, hot, unremarkable. And at around 3:30 p.m., with none of the guests on that day's episode of Dr. Phil tugging a single one of her heartstrings, Tanya Harris had stubbed out the last of her cigarettes. Her brother, down to a single beer in the fridge, shrugged his lukewarm consent. Like the afternoon in question, the busy bee store can seem, at a passing glance, unremarkable. It sits low-slung and slabbish on the corner, with steel bars shielding a random few front windows and neon beer signs and cigarette posters and local flyers crowding the remaining windows with a look of equal impenetrability. On some afternoons, this one included, shrink-wrapped pallets of soft drinks and cases of beer are parked out front. Most often it falls to a 54-year-old semi-employee named Ollie Morgan to unpack the pallets and haul their contents into the store. Ollie is more or less homeless. If you ask him where he lives, he'll point west. Ask him again the next day, and that same finger points east. And the Busy Bee's owners, a Vietnamese immigrant couple named Le Nu Quyen and Le Thi Hat, pay him in cash or merchandise, depending on his wants. Sometimes it's a $20 or $50 bill, other times a pickled egg and a Yoo-hoo. In exchange for this fluctuant compensation, Ollie also scoops up parking lot litter and hauls the trash out to the dumpster, and occasionally babysits the Lay's 3-year-old daughter Kim, who spent much of the first 2 years of her life confined to a playpen in a back corner of the store, by the mop closet, where her favorite activity was rolling a cold, unopened can of Red Bull around the playpen. Once the can warmed, she'd lose interest, at which point her parents or Ollie would replace it in the cooler and fetch her a fresh one, cycling through a dozen or more cans a day. More than anything else, however, Ollie appears to merely hang out, smoking cigarettes or chewing toothpicks outside by the front door, looking half security guard and half loiterer, his gaze sweeping the parking lot like that of a convenience store Argus. Newcomers to the store sometimes mistake his silence for surliness. But Ollie is mute. When he tries to speak, a bass monotone bleat emerges, like a foghorn. Little Kim sometimes imitates him, though the effect is more goatish, to her parents' delight, and to judge by his exuberant clapping, to Ollie's delight as well. Ollie was inside the store when Tanya entered that afternoon. The broil of the slanted sunlight looked to be defeating him. He was clinging to the front counter with a Yoo-hoo in one hand, his complexion liquid with sweat. She'd parked Cameron outside by the newspaper machine, beneath a window on which was hand-painted, not quite legibly, owing to the bars striating the words, "We accept EBT." The brightness level of Cameron's mood tended to dictate whether Tanya wheeled him in or left him outside. And today's mood, while not overly dark, was lethargic enough to dissuade her from bringing him in. It didn't seem worth the trouble. She asked if he'd be okay out there, to which he nodded vacantly, a groggy and almost pained-looking single nod. This brought a frown to her face, because while Cameron often seemed to hole up inside of himself in this way, as Tanya describes it, he usually did so in private, in their living room, or in the backyard by the grill, where on breezier days he often retreated with a six-pack and some cigs with his ears plugged with Patsy Cline songs. That she was over-vigilant with his moods was established fact. But the 6 months that followed Cameron's release from Brook Army Medical Center, when the phrase suicidal ideation entered her life, hanging there like a spiral of storm clouds banked out in the gulf, had left her with an acute fearfulness that felt as permanent as her tattoos. Even 4 years later, she couldn't help but interpret sustained moping as the potential prelude to self-annihilation. A case of indigestion had once been enough to spark panic in her, It had taken Cameron half an hour to convince the VA social worker Tanya had called that it was diarrhea, not suicide, currently threatening his existence. She asked him again, with her hands on her forearms. "Cam, you sure you okay? You want something besides beer?" "No," he said, and without looking up, flicked his left hand to dismiss her. "I'm all good." All good. To her, that's what he'd always been, her all-good little brother. People hadn't always gotten Cameron, who'd been a little too sensitive, her word, to fully connect with his high school football teammates, but not quite sensitive enough to click with softer-minded guys, the guitar players and tattooists Tanya favored. She'd never seen anyone fight harder than she'd seen Cameron fight one awful night after their mother died, when he put Tommy Landry into the emergency room with what even the doctors called a broken face. But she'd never seen anyone cry harder than him either. When their mother died, he wept for 24 hours straight, came out of his room to smoke half a cigarette, then went back in and cried for 12 hours more. At the age of 8, he spent 3 days and nights camped beside the backyard grave of his run-over dog to assist in case of the dog's resurrection. For the entirety of that time, his cheeks remained so wet and streaky that their mother fretted about mold developing. Their mother always said Cameron had a low boiling point, as well as skin thinner than an onion's, and as opposed to the Grinch on that Christmas show, a heart one size too big. People didn't tend to see the bulge of that double XL heart much anymore, Tanya thought, probably because Cameron was so quiet, and he'd only grown more taciturn since coming back from Afghanistan, his quietude sometimes competing with Ollie's. And those who did see it, like some of his nurses and therapists, seemed to ascribe it to his injury, because every veteran confined to a wheelchair gets awarded a heart one size too big. Tanya figured that was why the purple heart was a heart. She turned to soak up one more look at him before entering the store. "In retrospect," she says, "he looked so bleak out there, slumped in his wheelchair, his t-shirt already splotched with sweat stains, his chin drooping toward his chest, his shoulders slumped inward, his expression betraying not a single forward thought. Just the same backward thoughts he constantly recycled through his head. The what-if-I'd questions with which he quizzed himself daily." But she doesn't believe she considered all that then, in those few seconds before she slipped into the air conditioning. Maybe some of it. Tanya's mind tends to dart like a bullfrog navigating lily pads. If anything, she was double-checking to make sure she'd parked him in the shade. She was inside the store, by her own estimate, for 5, maybe 6 minutes. A more precise measurement of the time, however, comes from the Busy Bee's co-owner, Lei T. Hat, known as Hat, who received a call from the store's tobacco distributor at near about the same moment Tanya entered. A billing dispute kept her on the phone, according to her call history, for 7 minutes and 47 seconds. She ended the call almost immediately after Tanya's first scream. During those 7 minutes and 47 seconds, Tanya gathered up the milk and beer and Cap'n Crunch. Another customer was in the store at the time, a middle-aged man unfamiliar to Tanya and the owners. He purchased a pack of cigarettes and a Slim Jim and was out of the store by the time Tanya arrived with her arms full at the register. Ollie, she recalls, was standing a little too close to the register, appearing to be analyzing the nutrition label of his drained bottle of Yoo-hoo. If she hadn't known Ollie was Ollie, she might have lined up behind him. But instead, she squeezed herself into the aromatic space beside him and dumped her groceries onto the counter. Behind the counter, back toward the office door, Hat was scowling hard at whatever she was hearing over the phone, or possibly from the way little Kim was yanking her leg and pleading for something in Vietnamese, possibly both. After waving to Tanya, Hat's descending hand morphed into a single-fingered wait gesture that she aimed at her daughter, who ignored it. Quinn, hunching on a swivel stool behind the counter, tallied Tanya's purchase while half listening to his wife's conversation, at one point snapping, "Tell him I say bullshit!" which Hat ignored just as thoroughly as Kim had ignored her. Then with a sudden whip crack of a smile, Quinn focused on Tanya and her request for 2 packs of bonus value lights, which he had to stand up to fetch from the overhead cigarette bays, emitting a wheezy but accommodating groan as he did so. For the remaining 4 minutes, they talked. Neither Tanya nor Quinn can recall precisely what they talked about, which isn't unusual when Tanya's involved. Almost certainly the heat, they say. Probably the amount of that week's Powerball lottery, for which Quinn planned to drive to Louisiana the next day, as lottery tickets are illegal to purchase in Mississippi. And perhaps little Kim, whom Quinn, by his own admission, relentlessly brags about. Kim's had been a perilous birth, owing to underdeveloped lungs that landed her in a neonatal intensive care unit for her first 3 weeks. So for Quinn, every benchmark of growth, first steps, first words, first Coca-Cola, feels doubly momentous, a strike against fate that he savors trumpeting. At some point, they agree, Quinn must surely have talked about Tanya's brother. Whatever answer she gave, however, is lost to their memories. The unpaid total, $31.94, in blocky red numerals, shown on the register display as they kept talking, and as Ollie, beside her, gave up assessing his yoo-hoo and turned his attention out the window. Outside in his wheelchair, Cameron's head lolled from a sudden burst of nausea, or rather from some unfamiliar subspecies of nausea-like feeling that rolled through him from the bottom up, from his gut northward to his head. But then, just as quickly and mysteriously as it struck him, the sensation disappeared. Maybe a weird spurt of heatstroke, he thought, or a late-blooming pharmaceutical side effect, or more likely some kind of gas bubble, a common hazard with Tanya's cooking. Or maybe it wasn't anything worth diagnosing at all, because he seemed fine again. He fished out a cigarette and lit it. The parking lot was empty now, the dude who'd been in the store having left in a Ford F-150 bearing Hancock County plates. From the truck window, the dude had chucked an empty 16-ounce Coke bottle on his way out. Below a vibrant yellow billboard for Taka Vodka across Division Street, traffic coursed east and west, all those cars and pickups glinting drearily in the shimmy-shimmy heat. Someone pulled into the snowball stand across Division and hopped out of the car fast, as though to remedy a bona fide case of heatstroke. With the second or third drag Cameron sucked from the cigarette, the nausea returned, striking so hard and so fast that as if with singed fingers he tossed away the cigarette. He heard himself groan, and as he taught himself to do with pain during his long convalescence, he clamped shut his eyelids to shove blackness into his mind. This blackness had always helped, for reasons he suspected were uniquely personal and maybe a little weird. Without it, the juxtaposition of the pain and the visible world compounded everything, because that visible world, as he'd always known it, had never included the varieties of pain he'd experienced. Plus the world, peopled or unpeopled, staring back at him in those moments, added a layer of anxiety, left him feeling vulnerable, intruded upon, and in some peculiar way, ashamed. Closing his eyes, he'd found, allowed him to meet the pain on a more neutral field, by taking the fight inside rather than out and away from prying eyes. Except that it wasn't pain, or really even related to nausea. Not exactly, anyway. The sensation was more like an interior lightness or ethereality, as though helium were being slowly released inside him, or as though his bodily fluids were transforming into a buoyant vapor, a yeasty, floaty feeling. To try to extinguish it, he produced a vigorous belch. But this had no effect. The not nausea wasn't exactly uncomfortable, he realized, yet it was alien and powerful, and wanted alleviating. A sudden gush of saliva swirled around and beneath his tongue as he felt himself beset with dizziness or faintness. Again, something airy. Leaning forward in his wheelchair yielded some incremental relief, Cameron found. Leaning farther forward granted him another fraction of ease. He rocked himself forward to magnify this effect, swinging his head between his knees and feeling a slick rope of drool slap his chin. And then, God, then, Cameron Harris has gone over what happened next a 1,000-plus times in his mind, in thunderstruck variations of his what-if-I'd quiz, and then hundreds more times to doctors, nurses, friends, strangers, reporters, television producers, to his parish priest, to the investigator from Rome, to the people who wrote him emails and letters, and to the people who telephoned him in the darkest hours of the night from places like Malaysia and Albania, plus the ones who showed up unannounced and trembling on his doorstep. But still to this day, he cannot say if there was a signal, a command, a moment of purpose or clarity, or even an awareness of what he was doing. The closest comparison, he says, is a mindset that can sometimes develop during combat, when flooded with the effects of adrenaline, the brain shifts into a state he likens to autopilot, and you find you're obeying your body rather than directing it, that your hands and arms and legs are doing things you didn't wittingly instruct them to, and you feel like a passenger in your own body, swept along by the force of action and some bone marrow urge to stay alive. What Cameron did then wasn't conscious. He didn't decide to do it. He says he didn't even know he was doing it until after he'd done it. Where his memory kicks in is a Taka Vodka billboard. Whether or not his eyes were open before then, his first visual recollection is the billboard, and his first sensation was the bizarre instability he felt staring at it. Because the billboard was moving, was shifting within his frame of vision as though tilting from the collapse of its support structure, as though sliding off its struts. He was simultaneously aware of a strange and very close sound, the faint scritch of something on the asphalt beneath him. The tilting billboard above, the scrape sound below. Neither made sense to him until he glanced down. But what he saw there didn't make sense to him either, because those were his own red Nikes on the asphalt, which meant he was out of his chair. Which meant he was asleep and dreaming. Except that he wasn't. He was awake, and he was standing. And what's more, he was walking. He watched his left foot rise and then descend back to the asphalt a few inches ahead of its former position. That was walking, yes. That was its very definition. He matched that step with his right foot. By now he was consciously controlling his feet, his heart flopping in his chest like a mullet in a bucket. Cameron Harris, whose spine had been severed in Afghanistan, who'd been assured and reassured by brigades of medical authorities that he would never walk again, was walking slowly but steadily across the Busy Bee parking lot. His chest, so frenzied with fear and disbelief and incipient exultation, that he felt himself gasping for oxygen. At that very moment, just across Reconfort Avenue, Mrs. Dooley glanced up from her quilting for no other reason than Mrs. Dooley was always glancing up. What she spotted across the street caused her hands to bunch and shake, her quilting needle drawing a speckle of blood from a fingertip. For a moment she sat frozen, suspicious of hallucinations. In his final dementia-racked years, her husband Bobby had claimed to have seen his mother roaming their house, all the more remarkable and disturbing because as an orphan Bobby had never met his mother. She adjusted her glasses as a further guard, this time against a trick of the eye. But no, there he was, little, almost trouble Cameron Harris, his bottom half rendered useless by war, taking another fragile step forward like someone negotiating a high ledge, or the thin ice of a frozen pond, each step cautious and consequential. "Holy Jesus," she whispered, rising from her chair and shuffling in her house slippers to her porch rail. And then when he managed another step, this one longer and more confident, and all but graceful save the buckling of his bony, out-of-practice legs, she raised her head, and with the same strength on which she'd drawn to survive 4 hours in a floating refrigerator, she bellowed across Reconfort Avenue, "Holy Jesus, praise your name!" Inside the Busy Bee, Ollie was the first to notice. Without removing his eyes from the window, he let out a violent-sounding moan and grabbed Tanya's left arm, wrenching her toward him. Horrified, Quinn reached across the counter and with a hard yank on Ollie's big arm shouted, "Stop! Why are you crazy?" And with that, the three of them struggled to bust apart their triangle of armholds. All Quinn could think was that Ollie's brain, the fitness of which no one had ever affirmed, had somehow snapped, thereby confirming the apprehensions about Ollie his wife had spent years expressing, and sentencing Quinn to a pecked eternity of I-told-you-sos. Ollie was bleeding, and with his free hand motioning out the window, while Tanya, deploying the box of Cap'n Crunch, was bashing his shoulder, and from her mouth firing blue flames of curses. Quinn had surrendered his grip in order to come around the corner for a more significant rescue effort when he heard Tanya scream. With both her hands, she slapped her own mouth as Ollie, his point finally made, relaxed his grip on her arm and moved her toward the door.
"What?"
shouted Quinn, who as a shopkeeper of 16 years couldn't restrain himself from picking the squashed box of Cap'n Crunch off the floor.
"What's out there?"
When he saw, the Cap'n Crunch plopped straight back to the floor. Tanya remembers the sound of the bell on the door ringing as she exited the Busy Bee, three trebly toy-like chimes, and she remembers the light, the great white-yellow-blue blast of it smashing into her eyes as she stepped outside, a chilled breeze on her back as the air conditioning fled the store after her. She must have spoken her brother's name, she thinks, because at that moment Cameron turned. Somewhere in her peripheral vision, too, she caught sight of Mrs. Dooley, hightailing it across the parking lot with feebly wizened steps not so unlike her brother's, wagging her head with church pew jubilance, her mouth wide open as though to sing. Then her brother, his head still hanging, turned fully Tanya's way and launched a step toward her. His slight stumble drew Quinn a few feet forward from Tanya's side to help, but Cameron recovered, and with another step toward his sister, lifted his head to reveal a look of pure astonishment. A look unlike any she'd seen on his face or anyone else's. As the bell announced Hat and Kim joining them outside, Kim pleading,
"Nalakaisi! Nalakaisi! What is it? What is it?"
Tanya raised a hand to the sky to shield her eyes from the sun, or perhaps from some other raw and wondrous sky power her retinas were unequipped to withstand. No one said a word save Mrs. Dooley, who was indeed singing now, as perhaps she'd been singing the entire time, an ancient country hymn about just such an occasion that she, and everyone else gathered in that parking lot that afternoon, had neither expected nor even hoped to ever witness. After. Part 1. How precious did that grace appear, the hour I first believed. Chapter 2. Cameron Harris didn't call his primary care physician at the Gulf Coast Veterans Healthcare System that afternoon, nor did he call her that evening. He didn't call her the next day either, or even the next day. In fact, he never called her. She called him. Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas learned about Cameron's recovery from a front-page article in the Tuesday, August 26th edition of the Biloxi Sun-Herald, which her husband, Knapp, in accordance with daily routine, had laid on the counter for her that morning beside a mug of chicory coffee and a pint glass of the kale banana flaxseed smoothie he'd made.
That's my patient, she blurted,
before even sitting down. Standing side by side at the counter, they read the article and studied the accompanying photograph, which showed Cameron posed beside his empty wheelchair in front of the house on Reconfort Avenue, Knapp punctuating his reading with the same intermittent grunts of skepticism he accords news reports of insurance company benevolence or supposed regulatory crackdowns in the oil industry. Knapp Cuevas, the Knapp is short for Napoleon, a hereditary flourish he's never quite appreciated, is an attorney specializing in personal injury litigation. He was already late for a pretrial hearing in Gulfport, so he and Janice exchanged just a few words about the article before he left the house. She doesn't remember precisely what words, except that miracle was not among them. The origins of the word, like its liturgical evocations, are Latin. It derives from the noun miraculum, meaning an object of wonder, which itself sprouted from the verb mirari, meaning to marvel or to be astonished. And Janice was astonished that morning. Astonished most of all that Cameron, whose leg muscles after 4 years of disuse were in a severely atrophied state, had summoned the power to stand upright and walk. Slightly less astonishing was his spontaneous recovery from paralysis, which she felt certain would prove clinically explicable, though at the moment, as she marveled at the photograph, she was bankrupt of any theories. But the word miracle, in its current divinity-soaked usage, defined with elegant concision by the British novelist and theologian C.S. Lewis as an interference with nature by supernatural power. This was not among her theories, despite the Sun Herald's exuberant quotations from a local priest, nor was it a factor in her astonishment. Setting aside her belief, or disbelief, in any supernatural power, Janice tilts hard towards the latter, the concept of interference struck her as antithetical to science. A concession to the idea that the known laws of nature were not laws at all, but instead mere precedents. Subscribing to the possibility of miracles forced one to concede that scientific ordinances could be warped, or at least eluded. To Janice's thinking, this concession actually negated those ordinances. Because in science, the exception does not prove the rule. It disproves it. That nature still retained mysteries, she believed, was both a temporary and temporal condition. Whatever remained inexplicable about nature was simply waiting to be explained, like patients thumbing golf magazines before their scheduled appointment. Not surprisingly, hers is a minority opinion in Mississippi, which the polling organization Gallup in 2012 deemed the most religious state in the United States. Religion exerts more than mere influence in Mississippi, says the historian Reagan C. Jones, who's written extensively about faith in the South. It is a primary force in the state's politics, in its culture, in the particulars of its residents' daily lives. It's a crucial component of the state's very atmosphere. Perhaps more surprisingly, however, Janice's is also a minority opinion among physicians nationwide. Polls commissioned by the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City reveal that roughly three-quarters of doctors believe in miracles. In one poll, more than half of the 1,100 physicians surveyed claimed to have witnessed treatment results in their patients that they deemed miraculous. Allowing for semantic imprecision, miraculous is often used as a hyperbolic synonym for extraordinary, this remains a remarkable finding. That even among clinicians, steeped in the rigors of empiricism, a far squishier doctrine pervades. Nothing about Dr. Janice Lorimar Cuevas, mentally or otherwise, is squishy. Almost. Her physical diligence, for instance, mirrors her mental assiduity. A devout runner, she tries to clock at least 50 miles a week. She maintains a marathon time hovering around 2 hours and 55 minutes. And in 2013, she competed in a 50-mile trail run near Laurel, Mississippi, finishing in 9 hours and 40 minutes, fourth among the female racers. This exercise regimen, which she appends with Pilates classes and yoga sessions, announces itself in her appearance, in her taut, sun-polished skin, its deep tan subject to constant refreshment during her runs along the beach, in the way she keeps her licorice-colored hair almost always ponytailed, lest the opportunity for an impromptu jog arise, and in her tight, brisk, erect carriage, which suggests an asceticism at odds with the Margaritaville vibe of the Mississippi coast, where residents tend to approach life with much the same laissez-faire attitude one finds a short ride down the interstate in New Orleans. At 33, she exudes the discipline and glowy vigor of a young Olympian. But she also exudes something else. A hardened prosecutor's aura of certitude. A density of conviction that seems bricked, mortared, and immaculately leveled. One finds a clue to this mindset in a quotation from Vaclav Havel that's framed above the desk in her home office. Hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. She is the antithesis of Squish. The exception to that, and perhaps the explanation for it, though she waves off this line of controversial inquiry, is her family background. Janice is the eldest child and only daughter of Winston Lorimer, whose name might ignite sparks of recognition among readers of Southern literature in the 1970s. Born into a mildly prosperous but socially negligible family in Greenwood, Mississippi, his father did the accounting for a cotton broker. Winston Lorimer failed out of the University of the South in Sewanee before bouncing his way through a sequence of colorful jobs of the sort that used to pepper about-the-author bios. Circus hand, clam digger, piano player, game show contestant, ballroom dance instructor. In 1974, at the age of 27, he moved to Manhattan on a quixotic, bourbonized mission to rescue Esquire magazine. By force, if necessary, he later wrote, from what he saw as the craven overseers who'd forced out the legendary editor Harold Hayes. The mission fizzled. Lorimer never even made it as far as Esquire's offices on Madison Avenue, but he funneled that same quixotic zeal, with Bourbon Chaser, into another endeavor, writing fiction. In this, he was egged on by the author Truman Capote, whom he met through a mutual friend. For the next 3 years, Capote, often baroquely intoxicated during that era, served as a sporadic and oblique mentor to Lorimer. The novel that emerged in 1978 was Lieutenant Lucius and the Tri-State Crematory Band, the story of a Confederate cavalryman reincarnated as a psychedelic rock guitarist whose discovery of the aphrodisiacal effects of kudzu inspires him to resurrect the ancestral plantation as a kind of viney, carnal, southern-fried commune. Critical reception was lukewarm at best and snide at worst. The critic Elliot Fremont Smith in The Village Voice wrote that the effect was of Herman Hesse reincarnated as a pork rind. Yet commercially, the novel proved a minor sensation. Perhaps owing to a fascination with the New South that bloomed during the early years of the Carter administration, or possibly to the notoriety of a 7-page, 3-sentence description of a kudzu turbocharged orgasm, Lieutenant Lucius and the Tri-State Crematory Band was a Book of the Month Club main selection, spent 27 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and was eventually adapted into a network television movie starring Bruce Boxleitner in a somewhat tragic-looking rainbow wig. In the 3 years following its publication, Winston Lorimer rode high. When he married his publicist, Jacqueline Hernstein, the reception was held at Elaine's, a gift from Elaine Kaufman herself. When Jacqueline gave birth to a daughter they named Janice, the former Harper's editor and fellow Mississippi Delta native Willie Morris sprawled beside Winston in the waiting room with a cigar clamped between his teeth. Less than a year later, however, Winston Lorimer had all but disappeared. "I just wanted to come on home," is the way Lorimer explained it back then, and it's how he still explains his retreat, not only from Manhattan, but also from writing and publishing. His courteously firm refusal to expand upon this statement, however, plus its over-rehearsed luster and the syrupy smile with which he concludes it, conveys an aspect of deception, or at least evasion. But it's an oddly avowed deception. The smile doesn't pretend to correspond to the cornpone simplicity of the words. It's a flagrant overlay of facial irony, a wink of the mouth, a silent admission of something. But of what? Friends from his New York days received much the same unsatisfactory explanation at the time, and each of them nurtured his or her own pet theories, that the pressures of writing a follow-up novel crushed him, that he'd fallen in love with another woman at life's most inopportune moment, and hewing to some Ivanhoe-inspired code of decency, fled south to escape her, or that Capote had secretly written Lieutenant Lucius and the Tri-State Crematory Band, and stoked by its success was threatening to unmask himself as its author. "He left without so much as goodbye, so long," says Brock Meadows, a retired 60 Minutes producer who frequently occupied a bar stool next to Lorimer Delane's. "The theory we all settled on was gambling debts with the mob. It made as much sense as anything else, or as little sense as the case may be. Whatever did happen, anyway." What happened, on a skeletal level at least, is this. Winston Lorimar whisked his family from the Upper West Side to the outskirts of Greenwood. He bought a tumble-down farm and went about town in expensive Scottish bird-hunting attire. He drove rural backroads in a Chevrolet convertible while wearing antique leather aviator goggles. For 10 years, he zealously maintained the high score on the pinball machine at a Lafleur County juke joint known as Como's. He drank prodigiously and entertainingly, though for the era and for the Mississippi Delta, rarely to notable extremes. In immodest moments, which were many, he likened himself to Shakespeare, gone silent after the tempest, nestled into his retirement at Stratford. To literary New Yorkers, fewer and fewer of whom remained curious about Lorimar, as Lieutenant Lucius and the Tri-State Crematory Band faded from bookstore shelves, he might have appeared a recluse, a trippier version of Harper Lee. But down in Greenwood, he cut a voluble, boisterous figure. He gave readings to luncheon groups, judged high school writing contests, and edited a collection of mawkish vignettes about the Delta for a local publisher. When asked if he was working on anything new, however, Lorimar would contort his face into an expression of horror, according to one resident, and exclaim, "Work? Why would I ever want to work?" Despite being a Long Island Jewess, Jacqueline alighted gracefully in the Delta. By all accounts, she was a fluent and decorous hostess, an attentive and agile mother, three boys trailed Janice into the family, and a benevolent sort of nursemaid to her husband, whose literary chops seemed to exonerate him from the standard strictures of husbandhood. That those chops went unexercised never appeared to bother her. In fact, nothing her husband did or didn't do seemed to bother her. Her friends and children recall far more complaints about the lack of decent pizza in the Delta than any marital laments. But then, in 1991, when Janice was 10 and her youngest brother was 3, Jacqueline Lorimar commenced a swift and sudden decline. Day after day, in perceptible measures, she weakened. After a while, fatigue gripped her so tightly that even her eyelids couldn't muster the strength to stay open. The cause, finally established via neuroimaging in Jackson after a fumbly string of misdiagnoses by local physicians, was brainstem glioma, a catastrophically cancerous brain tumor. Her life expectancy forecast, even with chemotherapy, was 12 months. She managed to eke out only 5. It was years before Winston Lorimar divulged the bare facts of their mother's illness and death to his children. For a time he blamed gremlins that he said were creeping into his and Jacqueline's bedroom at night and sucking her energy out through little cocktail straws. "But don't worry," one of Janice's brothers, Randy, recalls him saying. "Kids' energy tastes like raw liver to them." In lighter moments, he ascribed her fatigue to hours of strenuous dancing that she did after the children went to sleep, mock scolding her for overdoing it with the Lindy Hop. Her hair loss, he told them, was an avant-garde fashion statement that was currently all the rage back in New York, which was also where he said she'd gone when she died. "It took me years to shake the idea that New York City was literally a ghost town," says Randy Lorimar. One might conclude sympathetically that Winston Lorimar, however clumsily, was trying to shield his children from an abominable truth that he himself couldn't quite accept, if a pattern wasn't already in place. Because while Lorimar might have abandoned writing, he has never forsaken fiction. The sign at the entrance to the family home reads, "Lorimar Plantation, circa 1848, which is about as bald as a lie can be shaved. Donovan Lorimar, Winston's grandfather, arrived in the Delta from Ireland in 1907 to work on the railroad, and the farm itself dates back only to the Great Depression." A clue to Lorimar's career withdrawal might lurk inside a comment he once made to a friend in Greenwood. "As an Irishman and a Southerner, I ravenously suckle defeat." The farm's history, much like his daily life appears to be, is an act of imagination. After writing a novel, he began living one. His fictions can be small. "If you see him at the diner," says one local, "he'll tell you how fine the chicken that he just ate was, with a big steak bone sitting right there on the plate." Or large, To get out of a dinner engagement, he once left a friend a voicemail saying he'd been stabbed in the neck by an intruder. They can also be strikingly self-aware, even meta. He's claimed himself the inspiration for Edward Bloom, the tall, tail-spouting protagonist of Daniel Wallace's 1998 novel Big